in the studio. I'm very pleased to have Blake Davis once again.
Once again, yes.
Yeah, it was almost exactly a year ago that you were here to talk about the plant.
Yes.
And what's going on there. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, that will soon be the center of civilization, right?
Possibly. we actually have broken ground for our anaerobic digester.
Yeah, I had the guys, what's the name of the company that makes that?
Eisenman.
Eisenman. I had a couple of Eisenman guys on several weeks ago, and it's really just amazing stuff.
For listeners that don't know, an anaerobic digester is a...
It's kind of a mechanical stomach that will take organic material, waste organic material, and turn it into biogas, which is primarily methane, and it essentially can replace natural gas. So we're taking waste and we're turning it into the equivalent of natural gas and using it to run a combined heat and power system. So we'll get all of our electricity, all of our heat, all of our cooling from that system.
So why wouldn't we just build a bunch of those all across the country and stop this fracking nonsense?
Great idea.
All right, let's do it. Where do I invest? You're talking about you're going to have to make smart investments in the next few years.
Well, we're one of the first in the city, and we're one of the first in the state, primarily for energy production. So hopefully our good example will actually lead other people to install these kind of units.
Why did you go with Eisenman? I know they've done it worldwide, but this is their first one in the United States.
It is the first one in the United States, but they've probably done about 100 in Europe for the purpose of energy. We're using a program that's from the state of Illinois that actually funds these, but almost all of them are downstate, and they're all basically being used as sewage treatment for contained animal feeding operations. So because we're trying to use it for energy, we wanted to go with a company that actually has some experience in designing and building them for energy production.
Confined animal feeding operations aren't going to talk about using these things as an excuse for building those facilities, are they?
They may, but the problem is that if you have 50 pigs, you make a little manure pile and everybody's fine with it. When you have 20,000 pigs, everybody in three counties knows you're there if you don't do something specific. So so these have been seen as pretty much a sewage treatment option for these big animal feeding operations. Because it's all in a contained thing, there's no there's not much odor, there's not much other problems from these.
Can they handle that kind of capacity?
Yep, big enough. Yeah, they're pretty much scalable. They started in India as very small units for household size things, and now they're, you know, we're doing one that will divert 32 tons a day of waste from the waste stream.
Blake Davis is the adjunct professor of sustainability and urban agriculture at the Illinois Institute of Technology. There's more to that title, but is that good enough for you?
Yes, that's fine.
he's got this title that goes on for a couple of paragraphs, but that's the one we'll go with. I want to read you something that I put together. If you go to my website, mikenovak.net, this week's show, as kind of an introduction to what we're going to talk about here this morning. In this past week, this is just this past week, folks, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, officially announced that 2012 was the warmest year on record in the lower 48 states. In some parts of Australia, drivers could not pump gas because it was vaporizing in the heat. Meteorologists were forced to come up with a new color for their weather maps to account for temperatures above 122 degrees Fahrenheit. The USDA declared much of the central and southern wheat belt a natural disaster area due to persistent drought that imperils this year's winter wheat harvest. It's been so dry around Chicago, this week's rains notwithstanding, that the Morton Arboretum has been watering its trees to make sure they come out of the winter healthy. Traffic lights recently stopped working in the city of Yakutsk as actual temperatures in Russia plummeted to minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit. We haven't had a snow event of at least 1 inch for more than 300 days, but Jerusalem got 6 inches of snow on Thursday. Russian radio declared that the world climate has gone mad. And the kicker, the draft third national climate assessment says that climate change is here, basically, in their report, and that the United States should prepare itself for increasingly threatened infrastructure, water supplies, crops, and shorelines. That's all in 1 week. this past week. I mean, this is after I booked you weeks and weeks ago to do this. Okay? So this is kind of a lead-in to what you presented at Bioneers, which is called the 50-Year Survival Plan for Climate Change. So the things I've read, they just play right into what you're saying.
Absolutely. All true. The reason I actually came up with the idea for the 50-Year Survival Plan was that I read a lot since I'm a college professor, and I've read dozens of books that 200 pages of this is the problem. It's all laid out very well, and then there's 10 pages at the end that essentially say, if I was God, this is what I would get the Congress to do and the President to do and business to do, and it's not a realistic. It's not a realistic plan for how to deal with that, because you're not going to get the government to pass a carbon tax, and you're not going to get them to make regulations that allow people to drive only a certain amount. And so we have these climate action plans that say we need to reduce the amount of carbon emissions by 80%, which basically means we have to reduce the amount of fossil fuels that we burn by 80%. And there is no plan on doing that. That is a rational goal based on the facts, but there's no plan on how to get there. And I think we make a couple assumptions about climate change that allow us to rationalize not doing anything. And I'll summarize those as, one, we think that it will happen sometime in the distant future. Two, that it will happen gradually and we'll get lots of warning about it coming. We can stop it anytime that we want to once we get the will to do it. And the solution requires agreement between governments, businesses, and any individual action won't make any difference. And I disagree with these on factual basis. And I also think they don't provide much in the way of direction for an individual citizen on what to do. So I'm trying to come up with a plan that actually circumvents all of those rationalizations and allows individuals to start doing something immediately. The basic reason I think the assumptions are false is that we have underestimated the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that would cause irreversible damage to the environment. Governments are routinely still looking at 400 parts per or 450 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere as being safe targets to look at. The other thing is we've overestimated our ability to reduce our use of fossil fuels, and therefore we're not able to achieve any of these targets that we need as benchmarks to get to this 80% reduction. So since we had the Kyoto Treaty, we're actually emitting 30% more carbon dioxide.
Which we didn't sign on to, by the way.
Which we didn't even sign on to, but the rest of the world did, and we're still using 30% more carbon dioxide, emitting 30% more carbon dioxide than we did. The other thing is that the target year, which was 1990, which we were supposed to be stabilizing our emissions at, we're 45% more emissions than that 1990 target date. So we're using energy more efficiently, but we're actually also using about 25% more of it than we did in 1970.
When you say we're using energy more efficiently, we know that to some degree the United States is. I roll my eyes when I say that. We know Germany is. We know there are certain countries. But there's a lot of countries that are just getting into,
the party's just getting started.
Right.
In India and China and Indonesia and Mexico and Russia and yes.
And I sent Lisa, an article the other week that I got sent about coal in the United States where, we're reducing our coal use here, but we still mine it and we send it all over the world.
Right.
So the net effect is that coal burning increases throughout the world.
Right. And the reason that we're primarily bringing the XL pipeline down is to try to export more Canadian oil to the rest of the world. So.
And one of the filthiest methods of extracting oil ever.
Shale oil and all of that stuff is bad. Fracking is bad. And it probably has a limited lifespan. We say lots and lots of it, but we're using lots and lots of natural gas to get all of these things out of the ground. So we're kind of saying, well, that's a throwaway. Well, so we have a little bit now, but that doesn't make it a throwaway because we're going to need it in the future.
So I don't even know where to start here. I mean, I looked at, and I appreciate you sending me the PowerPoint, and Lisa and Sarah. And I'll tell you what, my listeners, 773-763-9278, I'd welcome your phone calls about this and where we're going and why we're here. But part of the reason we're – I love the idea that you say we have to bypass what are perceived as current solutions because they're just – not adequate. I mean, you look at
they're not realistic, and I don't even think they follow sort of any normal pattern that we've ever seen action being taken. So kind of the 350.org people are saying, well, what we need is a mass movement like the civil rights movement, like the peace movement. And I was involved in both of those. And the problem is that all of us are still responsible. None of us have clean hands in this. So if the person's not driving, not using fossil fuels to heat their house, you know, then they can become part of the moral mass movement. But everybody is using all of these things every day, so they're all part of the problem. And I just don't find it plausible that we're going to, you know, be able to use those as a way of organizing people to make changes.
Well, Lisa was talking earlier about the little things you do in life to make a difference, and that has always been the meme of the environmental movement, is that you're not going to be able to walk down the road and shut off that coal burning plant, but you can recycle. You can drive less. You can compost. Obviously, you're all in favor of that. You're doing the anaerobic digester at the plant. There are just all kinds of different little things you can do. Are you saying that's not enough?
I don't think that's enough. The way I look at it, this is like we're going to save 5%. So this is like we're getting 5% off on buying the Gucci bag. You still have to figure out if that's going to work in your budget. The 5% isn't going to make any difference. We're talking about Americans needing probably to cut their fossil fuel use and their CO2 emissions by, you know, maybe a factor of 10 to get to the levels that will actually be sustainable on Earth. So we're not doing that with the 5 or 10% that you're saving by, you know, changing your light bulbs out and doing it. Those are all good things to do, but I think that it's inadequate for the problem that we're facing.
Right. I think it's an easy place to stay, but you got to keep doing the work. You have to continue educating yourself. What more can I do? What more can I do? And not just sit back and say, okay, I'm done. I put in my CFLs and I started walking to the grocery store. You're not done. That's a great start, but it's an evolution and it's a constant education. Going to talks like yours, talks like mine, learning what more can I do? What more can I do? Because we have to keep pushing.
Yeah, but I'm tired. Oh, come on. We've been hearing this for so long. You guys are just bullies.
You know? You'll be more tired when you start to live in the environment that we're creating for ourselves.
And okay, so let's make that transition. Although I do want to say one thing that you mentioned in your presentation, that the myth is that climate change and oil depletion will happen gradually and incrementally. And you say we're used to things happening this way. We plan our lives on it. However, it's not the way the world works. For example, there were over 11 million auto accidents in the United States in 2011. Which resulted in 32,000 deaths. None of the people who died or were hurt anticipated their accident or planned for them. Climate change looks to occur as a series of discontinuous events punctuated by relative stability. Explain that.
Okay, so the economy's going along, everything's fine. Then we're building up kind of this problem with home mortgage debt. And then all of a sudden something happens and the economy crashes. Now, it doesn't crash to the ground, but a lot of people's houses are foreclosed. A lot of people are wiped out. And it's been, you know, 4 years now, 5 years almost, that we have sort of just a weak economy and things haven't recovered to where they were. This is the kind of shock that I think will happen.
And repeatedly or
repeatedly and continuously. And I think that it's all part of a contraction of the economy. So higher oil prices problems with food being grown. All of these things will cause shocks to the economy that will damage the economy. And so we'll have these sort of continuous events. We'll recover a little bit from them, and then something else will happen in some other connected part of the economy, and then we'll have a problem there.
These idiots in Washington who are going to take us to the brink with the debt ceiling in an economy that's already fragile.
Right.
And you make the argument that 2008 was just the beginning, that we will not recover from that, that this is now the new norm.
This is the new norm until something else happens, and then we'll have another shock, and that will be the new norm then. And what are the other shocks that are possible? You know, people owe lots and lots of money on credit cards. That's not secured debt. People owe student loans. Any of those could blow up, or something else. Gas could spike up to $8 a gallon. Any of these things would put sort of an intolerable shock on the economy.
And your point also is that those people who have prepared for this, in that they've put away funds for their retirement, for their kids, whatever. Well, when those shocks happen, that money's gone. Just ask the people who lost a bundle in 2008.
Right.
And that money's gone. And so you're saying you need a new financial model here.
Right. So if you believe that we should have a sustainable world, a sustainable society, then you need to have a sustainable economic system that goes along with it. The problem is that our economic system requires about 2 to 3% growth per year to just sort of stay where it's at. If we have less than 2 to 3% growth a year, we end up with recession. With the price and the availability of fossil fuels going down, I believe that we're looking at a contraction of 5 to 10% per year, rather than growth of 2 to 3%. So if you look at the difference between our expectations that we need 2 to 3% positive growth and the fact that the economy is probably going to decline, is actually going to contract, then what that means is that people's investments are in the existing economic system. If the existing economic system is contracting, then people's retirement isn't growing. It's actually being reduced. So you look at what happened to people's 401ks during the, you know, collapse of the housing market. You know, people lost 20-30% of their actual principal that they had saved in the bank. And if the same contraction keeps going on, the same thing's going to happen. And so people are invested in the existing paradigm. They don't have tools, skills. They don't have fertilizer. What they have is an IOU against the existing economy.
You're actually making a really good point. We're getting ahead of ourselves, though, because I'm going to ask you to pull that microphone just a little bit closer, if you can do that. But that's part, when you say changing paradigm, you're serious. It's not just that we've got to tinker around the edges. It's, you really do need to invest in fertilizer and hardcover books and let's take a quick phone call, because there's just so much my head is going to explode. Let's go to line one and bring Chris from Palatine. How you doing, Chris?
Oh, not too bad, Mike. Winter is back, for at least temporarily, in Chicago. A couple points. Question one, Tom Hartman talks about this periodically, about solar panels. Germany is using and has encouraged its population to put solar panels on the rooftops to generate electricity. And he was saying that, because it's been so successful, you know, that they don't have to build power plants, because they're actually generating the excess amount of energy and sending it back into the grid. Wanted to know what your thoughts are about that. And then the other thing, though, here I want to be more of the pessimist. We can do whatever, but we still have two huge countries, China and India, that are polluting their, you know, merry little heads off like it's the 19th century. And aren't what we're doing, you know, what can we do to prevent, you know, them, because it's global, because it's called global, you know, so isn't their pollution really going to affect the climate? And no matter what we do, you know, aren't we just doomed to have that same problem unless they get their act together?
Yeah, I think the problem is that we can't prevent them from doing anything. And so Germany's going to be happily putting in windmills and solar collectors, and China's going to be building one new coal-fired power plant a week. And so what's the net effect of that? It's not less carbon, it's more carbon.
Okay.
But what about the Chris's comment about what's going on in Germany? Why can't that be a model for the rest of the world?
It can be, but remember the German model comes from German government's decision that we don't have that any oil on German soil. We need to get oil from somewhere. It would make more sense for us to tax ourselves a little bit more to set up a more renewable system. Even so, that's only probably about 30% of their electric. The rest is still coming from gas and oil and coal.
So even Germany's not moving fast enough.
Right. And do we think that in the United States that we're going to be able to get a system through that will, you know, provide the same kind of incentives? We're desperately trying to hold on to the one incentive we have, which is for windmills, for a technology that really makes, you know, kind of complete economic sense. Do we think that somehow we're going to do a big solar program that's going to turn us to a solar country in the next 20 years? It's possible, but I don't see where that's coming from under our current system. Essentially, what I see is that people are asking the government to do something because they actually have the wherewithal to do it. If governments really passed carbon taxes and did all that, we could probably solve this problem.
That would be a really simple way to start, wouldn't it, with a carbon tax?
Yes, that's probably the most straightforward thing. You buy a ton of coal, you get charged $10. The $10 goes towards setting up a renewable energy
system.
But
that's not even being talked about.
That's not even on the legislative agenda, at least in this country.
Yeah. I think I've heard some whisperings because I went to D.C. in 2009 to lobby for it, and unfortunately that Congress did not get it through. But I have heard some whisperings in D.C. that conversation may be beginning again. Mm-hmm.
Well, so basically, I think people are asking the government to do something because the government has the wherewithal to do it. The problem is the government doesn't have the will to do it, or they don't have the ability to get themselves organized to do it. And, you know, as long as the general public is confused about climate change, the government's not going to all get together and move in one direction.
That's Blake Davis. And thank you, Chris, for the phone call. Always great to hear from you. Blake Davis, adjunct professor of sustainability and urban agriculture at the Illinois Institute of Technology. When we talk about this economic system declining and at the same time, the climate change in the world, these are interconnected, aren't they? It's not
Yes.
two different things happening.
Right, and I actually think there's three things going on. There's peak oil, which means we have declining energy supplies. There's climate change, which means we're having problems with food and water and all of these things. And I also think we have a strategic material, so food, metals, all of those things. If you try to fix any one of the problems, climate change, that negatively affects the other two things. So what I think the governments are going to do is they're going to define this as an energy problem, and they're going to devote a lot of resources to building windmills and drilling for oil and doing nuclear power. They're going to do all of those things. But the problem is then we'll be running low on copper and silver for solar collectors. And so these kind of, you know, Marshall plans to fix the problem will end up hurting lots of other segments of the economy. So you really have to accept the fact that there's limits. The limits are imposed by the earth and the thermodynamics, and there's no way around that.
All right. We had a caller that has a very simple question, and we should all be asking this, what's the solution? But the solution at this point is pretty complex.
The solution is complex, and I also think you have to look at a set of stages that we're going to go through. So
that's what I, and so you're predicting that over the course of the, let's say the next 50 years,
right,
that we're going to go in stages. You talk about our system in decline, and that decline is going to happen over, say, the next 50 years or so. Talk us through the stages.
Okay. So, the first stage, I think, will take, you know, this is obviously, this is fortune telling, and nobody's going to be perfect at this, but I think for about 10 years, we'll have the fiction of business as usual. So, people will still have jobs, energy will be more expensive, but basically everybody's going to live where they're living, do what they're doing as well as they can. During this time period, the government's going to try a lot of things like a big renewable energy program. And by the end of 10 years, essentially what we're going to find out is that this was either ineffective or it didn't work at all. So we're going to do coal gasification and we're going to do carbon sequestration. We're going to try all these things to fix the problem, and essentially it's going to fail.
Why? Because it's not done on a grand enough scale?
I think because really living at the level of lifestyles that we're living is going to be impossible with the energy resources that we're going to have available.
So it's our consumption.
Right. Right. So
and soon to be consumption of the rest of the world as they attempt to become what we call first world nations.
Correct.
All right.
Yeah. Right. So there's just not going to be enough energy to live the lifestyle that we're living. So if we're not willing to voluntarily choose a simpler, less energy.
And we're not.
Then it's going to be brought to us forcibly. And so that's why I don't worry about the political things. And I've been political, small p, big p, my whole life. And I just think that it's too late. What's going to happen is just going to start happening, and we're going to have to deal with it. So the 50-year plan is really, how do you deal with it? And we've always had this idea that, okay, so whatever happens, we're all going to have to get together and go in that direction. And I think that that might be unrealistic at this point. You know, we might have to just look at our own survival and our own family survival and our own community survival and not drag everybody who's disinterested or, you know.
Are you from Idaho?
I am not, and I don't have guns in my house, but.
And you talk about kind of this survival of the fittest. You get into this mentality, not after the first 10 years, but after that.
Right. So
and what scares me about that is that the crazies out there who are screaming and foaming at the mouth about their Second Amendment rights right now are the ones who are going to be in better shape to survive a world like that.
Well, okay. So here's my thoughts on that. I think that the individual survivalist is in a very bad position to actually survive.
Really?
They may survive, you know, zombies coming out of the grave, but we're talking about survival forever, for a long period of time. If you have a gun, you still have to go to sleep sometime. And if you need medical attention, even if you're a doctor, you need somebody else who's a doctor to take care of you if you get sick. So I think we're really talking about surviving as communities. And I think the ideal community sizes are 75 to 125. This is based on some research I've done on the Amish, the Hutterites, some of the other people who live in more sustainable ways than we do. Those size communities can be integrated and they can cooperate with each other to do bigger projects. But that size community seems to be the size community where there's the least social friction and where you need not develop a huge bureaucracy to make all of the community functions work. So things like, food, fuel, clothing, I think these are best done at community scales. So the 50-year plan includes a personal what do I do, regardless of who I'm with, but it also talks about creating communities, organizations that will also weather this decline in our economic system.
And somebody's way ahead of you or reading your mind. I got a tweet here from Celesta who says, for those living in the suburbs, we are locked into an unsustainable life. And that's kind of key to what you talk about.
Yeah, so I see the meta problems with what we're doing is actually threefold. One is that most of our wealth is invested in the wrong things. And I already kind of mentioned most of our wealth is in IOUs to a system that I don't think is going to be particularly healthy when we need to cash those IOUs in. We're also living in the wrong type of structures and in the wrong places. So something like 57% of the people in the United States live in the suburbs. Suburbs are tremendously wasteful in terms of energy. You're required to have a car to go everywhere. And I don't think that structure is going to last. We're going to need to figure out what to do about that. And finally, the last thing is that most people don't have any skills or knowledge that they need for absolute survival. They don't know how to get water. They don't know how to grow their own food. They don't know how to make their own clothes. We're all part of these giant, complex, expert-run systems that require lots and lots of energy. You reduce the amount of energy they have available. All of a sudden, there's nobody that comes and picks up the garbage every day.
I'm a radio guy, okay? I do know how to grow my own food, thank goodness, but that's about it. So otherwise, I'm kind of a barnacle on the hull of society here.
I'll sew your clothes and you grow my food. Deal?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay,
yeah.
See, and that's how we start pulling the community
together,
right?
And that's how we start to develop a community. And I think that the real issue is that individuals can actually make those 180-degree changes that we're trying to get the government to make. And I don't think the government can make those 180-degree changes. But if you want to walk out of this building today and go live in India and, be at the foot of a Maharaji, you can get on a plane and do that. You can make that 180-degree change in your lifestyle, and you could do it tomorrow if you want to.
But you say in a few years, we won't be able to get on a plane and go anywhere.
Right. I'm actually in the process of writing a book, and I have a chapter called Flying to Mecca, and I compare using a plane as the same kind of thing, a once-in-a-lifetime thing, as going to Hajj because of the amount of fuel that you use, the amount of carbon that you emit on any kind of airplane flight. And I think it's something that your children will not do that you do. That you have done and that you can do now, your children will not do it.
So get those plane rides in now and go to Paris tomorrow because you're never going to see the Eiffel Tower.
You may never see the Eiffel Tower in 2030.
Don't worry. There's one in Disney World. It's just as good. So what about the rest of technology? One of the things you mentioned in this, and for folks, for listening, and I'm going to get to those calls and they are coming in, that this sounds like doomsday scenario. This is Blake's idea. This is where we could go if we don't act. And it might happen. And I'm condensing a lot of things in a very short time here in an hour. But you do mention technology, preserving technology for future generations. And I was thinking about that after I looked at your PowerPoint. What could I save? If I were thinking of the technology I wanted to preserve, it would be solar, I would think, so, because then you can power an individual piece of equipment.
Or small hydro
or something like that. What about this technology? If we don't have a large power grid, a lot of the stuff we count on now, cell phones and computers and stuff, would become marginal, right?
Right. And if you think about all the technology, all of it's in a big infrastructure. The infrastructure is very energy dependent. There's a big facility that used to print all the phone books down on the south side of Chicago, Donnelly Printing. It's being turned into a server farm for all of these internet providers. Well, it's taking as much energy as a small city in the United States. Think about all the clean rooms that we have just to make things like hard disks and cell phones. Those are extremely expensive. We have hundreds of those across the country. Let's say energy doubled in price, which I don't think is unrealistic in the next 10 years. we're going to have to make decisions about where we want that to go. Do we want cheap hard drives, or do we want solar collectors so we have energy in our houses to use the hard drives? We're going to have to make those decisions. Everything is dependent on this infrastructure, and all of us for our basic needs are dependent on infrastructure. And I think we need to step away from the door. We need to just move back a little bit and say, what can I do to be more self-reliant? Because I may have to be more self-reliant in the future.
I got to tell you, and Sarah, you probably noticed this, that Twitter is exploding with comments. If you have any of the good ones here, feel free to pop them in, because I can't see all of them. But one of the first ones I see is, does your guest have an opinion about where in the world is the best place to live when we start our 75 people communities?
Yes, I do. And actually, I think that you should start building the skills and developing the communities in this sort of short term, which I say is about 10 years. So I wouldn't move any place now. If I was in Phoenix, I would say, yeah, okay, there's not going to be any water here. You definitely need to move. The Midwest is still going to be maybe not the breadbasket of the world, but it's still going to have productive agricultural resources. We still have fresh water in the Great Lakes.
And it's getting lower and lower every day.
Although it's getting lower and lower. So I think Chicago might be a place where you kind of commit to your community, you dig in, you develop the resources and the people around you to help you do it. I would say that you do need to keep your eye on the long term. So if you're looking at the long term, that's probably sometime after 30 years. So 30 years from now, it'll be more clear how fast climate is changing and how extreme the variation is going to be. At that point, you might want to consider moving further north. So we're talking maybe northern Ontario and Canada.
Because that climate will have changed.
That climate will have changed, but it will have improved over what it is. So it'll be more like the climate that we have in Chicago
so
right now.
So what we need to do is launch an invasion of Canada so we control that country.
Okay, so you know what we do on the Mexican border? I wouldn't be surprised if in 30 years that's what the Canadians are doing on the southern border of Canada, trying to keep Americans from getting into Canada.
Oh, I love it. Turnabout is fair play.
Fair play, absolutely. Oh, yeah. That's right. We'll be those wetbacks from New York and Chicago. And
oh, my gosh. Oh, dear. So that's 30 years down the road, and until then, folks need to make decisions about what it is they think is important for society.
Right. So I think we have 10 years in which there'll be at least the fiction that life goes on exactly the way it is now. Our lifestyle keeps slipping, but we're going to get back in the saddle again, just kind of like the way people talk about the economy. We're just waiting for it to come back. After 10 years, it's going to be obvious it's not coming back, and then people are going to make more dramatic lifestyle changes. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that people are going to do is they're going to move back to the cities. And the reason is because the cities actually operate more efficiently. They use energy more efficiently. You have enough density so that you have big, huge blocks of apartments that are much more efficient than a whole bunch of separate individual houses sitting in the suburbs. You also have the access to public transportation. If gas is $10 a gallon, nobody's going to be driving their car for anything that they absolutely don't need to drive it for. And so being in the city where you're a block or two from some type of public transportation is going to be a very efficient system, and people are going to move to the city for that reason. The problem is that by 30 years out, the energy supplies are going to keep declining, and even though the cities are the most efficient places to live, they're still not going to be able to get the resources they need, and therefore they will start to collapse just from lack of resources. So they'll be the most efficient way to live, but they won't have enough resources to maintain that sort of efficient lifestyle. And then you probably need to look at moving someplace where you're closer to agricultural resources. And so then maybe you're really looking about going back to the land.
Let me ask you a question. I mentioned earlier somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but not necessarily so, that an entity like the plant could become the focal point of civilization because it's self-sustaining.
Anything that's self-sustaining will be good. In the city, we have 70,000 vacant lots. Right now, they're an eyesore. They're a social problem. Those are all productive assets we just haven't used yet. We haven't started to use. We've got millions of square feet of buildings that could be turned into vertical farms. All of this is going to be, you know, all this is money into the bank for people who do it, so that when we get to that point where it's hard or it's expensive to get food from someplace else, we have a source of it right here in the city. And it may sound like I'm depressed, but I'm not depressed. I'm working on the plant. I'm helping people build greenhouses. There's lots of work to be done, but I think there's a lot of people who just want to deny that there's a problem. And so if you keep denying that there's a problem, you won't do anything to start the solution. I know there's a problem, so I can work on the solution.
You know, there are people listening now who are saying, that guy's crazy. Well, he doesn't know anything, all right? I mean, he's only a professor at IIT, but that guy's crazy. There's a lot of crazy smart people out there, and that's what you're dealing with.
Right, and you know, like I said, you know, I don't think everybody's going on this voyage together. The last time the Earth was sustainable was sometime around when we started the steam age. We were working on wood. The wood had to grow, so we were sustainable. At that point, we had 1 billion people. We have over 7 billion now. We're probably on our way to 8.5 billion people. Without all of this stored fossil fuels that we're using to support the carrying capacity for all these 8 billion people, we don't have all those people. Somebody's got to go.
Okay. We have a bunch of phone calls. We're going to get to those. That is Blake Davis, 50-year survival plan for climate change. Wow, the phones have lit up. Twitter's lit up. I knew this would happen. That's kind of why I was looking forward to this show. Blake Davis from IIT is here in the studio. We're talking about the 50-year survival plan for climate change, a talk he did at the Bioneers Conference in November. And you are putting a book out about this?
Yes, I'm working on a book right now.
Okay. Well, you get back to me when we do that book. Let's go to the phones. And Mike in Waukegan, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hi. You know, I wanted to ask the professor this. You know, according to my sources, approximately two-thirds of the Earth's foliage has been destroyed since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. And it seems to me like even if we were to quit adding carbon to the atmosphere, there's still that fact. In other words, the Earth is a third as healthy as it was before that, up until that period. And why don't we do more to, and this is the key operative word here, to plant vast numbers of trees and also other plants that can add a lot of oxygen into the atmosphere due to their highly foliant ability, you know, something like, for example, industrial cannabis hemp. I don't understand. This to me seems like something we can do. You know, like I know we can't, you know, quit driving the cars and shutting down the power plants and all that. But it seems like we can do that. So I don't understand why we aren't pursuing that.
That's a great question, Mike.
Obviously a great idea. The problem is if you look at the amount of deforestation in the rainforest and other places in the world, we're not even anywhere near keeping up with the amount that's being destroyed every year. So how do we get, you know, governments and businesses and the people who operate at that scale to do the good things? And that's the problem. And I don't think we can get them to do it. And so I'm trying to suggest other ways that people can take action that'll make a difference.
Mike, I'm going to bring in some more people. Thank you. That's a great question. I'm trying to get as many as I can because a lot of people are interested. Let us go to Alan in Lake Bluff. You're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hi. Hi. Yes. There's so many topics involved with this, and it's to sum it up, you could almost talk about the fact that we've got a very simple math problem here. We have a finite Earth, and we've got infinite expansion as far as population, and we have an irrelevant economic system because there's no accurate pricing model. And as far as you go, unless you can turn it into money, we can't get our message out.
Yeah, and I think you're just Blake. He's just proving your point, right?
Yep. There's a lot of people that would be afraid for everybody to recognize the seriousness of the situation. If you're selling energy, obviously you want to keep selling energy. If you're an environmental organization, you don't want people to head for the hills and stop working towards your goals. So I think the first thing is really to recognize the seriousness of the problem. And then I'd like to at least say this is one way you can go about trying to protect yourself and your communities. There may be lots of other ones, but at least I'm putting forward one that people can do. And then we go from there and people can riff on that. It's kind of like the plant. We wanted to show an actual working example. Not an artist rendering, but something people could come and touch and say, okay, I know I can do that.
Ellen, thank you so much. Great comment. Let's go to Dan in Chicago. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. I think I've been working on ways of tying together the different themes, and it always seems to come down to economies of scale, of local efficiencies, of where to use them. And of course, the big corporate industrial models are efficiencies of scale. But the place to start with in terms of what you're working with is the energy that comes from the sun. I'm quoting this from the preface to the book on alcohol biofuel, which I've brought up a couple of times. All of the Earth's operational energy, this is by Buckminster Fuller, comes from the sun, from the stars. The 200 million square mile surface is always there. It's always sunlit. That fabulous untapped amounts of energy are coming every second. Coal and oil, if that theory is correct, is based on the historic sunlight and using that up, if that's how it's made. But at any rate, the amount of energy, if that's computed just in terms of biofuels, the computations by the an underread book that Tom Hartman said should be read by everybody, called Alcohol Can Be a Gas.
Remember what profit actually is. In the world up until 300 years ago, profit was turning the power of the sun through plants into things people could use. That was the profit. How efficient you were doing that was the amount of profit you made. We have to get back to that because profit now is completely devoid of the meaning that it used to have, which meant you're actually creating things from sunlight that we can use.
I want to thank you, Dan, for that. I want to have enough time to get to line 11 because Rick DeMaio is has called back. I knew you would, pal.
Yeah, I know. You know what, Mike? Long-time listener, first-time caller. But I just wanted to say, Professor Blake, have you ever heard of the book The Green Metropolis written by David Owen?
I have. Yes, I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book, and I really urge, Mike, all your listeners to buy a copy. It's a simple read. It may take, a couple of days to go through it, but it really talks a lot about what Mr. Davis is saying about how urban environments generally tend to be more efficient with their usage of energy. And I'm just going to put this real quickly because I know you want to get to a couple of maybe callers here to finish up. But when I was down at the conference in Austin, Texas, the state climatologist was talking about how a bill that took almost 3 years to finally get kicked down the road through the Texas state legislature, was held up because a couple of groups came out, and he actually showed video to the crowd, the attendees, and had a person stand up and say, this was a think tank, said, God did not create people to use the earth. God created the earth for people to use. And think about that. If you have people that are able to get into the Texas State House and profess those beliefs, how much work do we have to do just to get that particular type of thinking turned in a way that can actually be useful as opposed to be detrimental.
Talk to you next week. Thanks for that comment. What do you got to say about that, Blake? We have about 30 seconds.
Okay. I agree. I think that we look for governments, we look to businesses because big, they have those economies of scale to do it. And so we need to find other ways to do it.